ticket revenue, and then we can certainly verify what 6% of that is. So in terms of the money coming to the city, we have all the you know, source documents we need to verify that. And then in addition, you know, these events have been going on for a long time. We've been getting the 6% for a long time, so we have all the historical data. We do our own projections, and so we know what to expect. And if there's any variances, we take up that issue with the Blazers. So that I think we're well protected in terms of knowing what we're entitled to under the 6%.
So with respect to the Coliseum itself and just the Coliseum, it doesn't matter to us then whether the Blazers make money or don't make money on a particular event. We just get 6% of each ticket sold, and that doesn't vary.
That's the case. We get 6% of ticket revenue. We do see aggregate monthly reports that show all the revenues, all the expenses in the Memorial Coliseum building, so that helps us keep track of net profit or net operating loss, because the city does share in years when there is an operating profit. So we do see that in the aggregate on a monthly basis. What we don't get, and which is reflected in the minority report, is an event-by-event breakdown of all revenue for that event, all expenditures for that event, and whether or not a particular event was profitable. That information really isn't essential to the city in terms of the operating agreement, and that's something that is not required. Our focus on revenue to the city is 6% of ticket fees and parking revenue, and we receive all the detail we need to verify those revenues on a monthly basis when we receive that revenue.
Did I understand you to say that at the end of each year, if the Coliseum is profitable, we get a percent of that money as well?
Yes, 60% of profits would come to the city. 40% of profits in the Memorial Coliseum are retained by the Blazers.
So then why isn't it in our interest then to make sure that the profits that they realize are being properly represented if we can't look at event to event to determine whether they're profitable or not? Are we just taking their word that the 6% profit they're giving us is in fact?
Well, 6% ticket revenue is verified by the Ticketmaster documentation.
I'm distinguishing that from you. I thought you said that once a year we get a percentage of the profits in addition to the ticket revenue.
Well, we get monthly reports that show all the revenues to the Memorial Coliseum, all the expenditures. It's based on a budget that the city we review and approve on an annual basis. So we monitor on a month-by-month basis the budget versus actuals. And so in that way, we keep track of the net profit or net losses in the building.
Let me articulate my question a little better. My understanding was there's two sources of revenue. We get 6% ticket revenue, and that you said that if the venue is profitable, we get a percentage of that in addition to the ticket revenue.
Correct.
Okay, so I'm just asking, how do we ascertain independently that they're representing to us accurately what the profit is?
Mm-hmm. We do have the right to audit. It's been a couple of years since we've done that, but we can, on an annual basis, ask for an outside audit of the MC financials. What we tend to do is just trend the information. You know, we have the history back to 93 on the building. So we generally know the mix of events, the type of sales that are likely to go on. We know what the operating costs are on an annual basis. We see how those costs change on an annual basis. So we have a pretty strong feel for how the building's going to perform. But we haven't in a few years taken that extra step to actually hire an auditor.
So, but can an auditor go in? And the reason I'm asking is Jay said that individual event differentials are kept confidential. Are you telling me that an auditor can go in and actually look at these numbers and break them down, including whatever that is, the individual event?
They would look at all revenues and all expenditures. I don't think they would look on an event-by-event basis. They would look at what are the aggregate expenditures in the building, what's the aggregate revenue, and they would check source documentation to make sure all that information is accurate. What you probably wouldn't ask an auditor to do is break down the 130 to 150 events in the building and do an individual audit on every event. That is probably not something that will be a normal audit.
Can I ask a clarifying question? Does the city have the right to do that, though? You've stated that might be expensive and cumbersome, but does the city have the right to send our auditor in and look at the 100 and some events if we so chose?
I think we need to do a legal review on does our auditing ability extend to an audit of specific events? It certainly does for the aggregate.
And I guess
I'm sorry.
I was going to say that, you know, I understand that we don't share in losses.
Correct.
But under the agreement, we have a piece of the action if there is a profit.
Correct.
And I think there's at least in my mind now, a significant question about how we actually monitor that. Mm-hmm. And aggregate data is one thing, but I don't know how you actually audit off of aggregate data. Right. This is not to suggest that the Trailblazers aren't being completely forthcoming in all the data. I'm wondering from an auditing point of view how you can. It seems to me there's implicit in that if you're just looking at aggregate data, you're just looking at trend lines, you're looking at historical things, which may actually be perfectly reasonable, except it may not actually be something that is a thorough audit that mm-hmm. gives. And in addition, in the minority report, the claim is made that certain information was requested, operating income, expense data, programmatic history, and other kinds of data that is published by other publicly owned operators, and we were given a copy of the Spokane facility. Can you tell us without talking to legal whether that is information the city has the right to obtain?
And we have provided to this stakeholder group we get, you know, a monthly statement from the Blazers on the operations of the Memorial Coliseum, and then we get a year-end summary report. And those were provided to, you know, the PDC staff and then on to the steering committee. What was asked for and reflected in the minority report was this event-by-event breakdown of profitability on an event basis. We do not get that information. It's not required under the operating agreement, and I think as the Blazers have said, they consider that, you know, kind of proprietary business information, and they, you know, they do not want to release that.
But if I could interject, I would like our auditors, and I've said this as part of the process, and this is, I would make clear in an amended operating agreement, while the information might stay with the Blazers because of their concern about the proprietary nature of it, I do think making sure that we, our auditors, can look at that and feel that and have confidence that it is being, expenses and incomes are being logged appropriately, I do think that that would be an improvement to the operating agreement, to clarify that we absolutely have that right. Granted, it might not be something that is released publicly, but at least our auditors will have had a look at it.
And I would say that for me to be able to vote to award any one of these proposals to any one group, I would want to see not just a commitment to do that, but an audit. So I think that needs to happen.
A baseline.
As part of this process as soon as can be done. And that certainly what the mayor says is absolutely true, that any records looked at by our auditors are confidential and would remain confidential. And I'm not asking that I see what the breakdown is, but I don't see how we can adequately know that they're doing what they're supposed to do under the agreement unless we have the ability to independently verify what the income is. And that means, I assume that means that the individual event differentials that Jay said are confidential have to at least be available to our auditors, mm-hmm. who I assume will sign confidentiality agreements, but they need to go in and assure us that the income that's being reported is accurate.
We can get going on getting an audit organized.
And I'd be interested in the question that you said needed to be asked as to whether or not we had the legal right to ask for that information, albeit confidentially with our auditors. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to do that before the RFP process is concluded and comes back to us. So I think that's going to make a big difference in how I view various proposals.
And I think that's important to establishing that baseline.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Brian, you were getting up. We'll now turn to public testimony. You must be the first person. You must know you're the first person. Carla, can I please call the first three names?
Okay. First three are Brian Libby, Harley Waddell, and Jeff Belushi.
Thank you for your perseverance. Welcome back to the City Council. So in this particular hearing, you just need to state whether you're an authorized spokesperson or lobbyist for any organization, if you're speaking for yourself, and you'll each have 3 minutes. Who's the third?
Jeff Belushi.
I'd like to say he.
Okay. Thank
he
you.
Had to leave.
Aaron Ladd.
Mr. Ladd.
Thank you. And they'll be followed by Stuart Emmons, Randy Rappaport, and Steve Liske.
Please proceed, Mr. Libby.
Thank you, Mayor Adams, and members of the City Council for the opportunity to speak with you today. To answer your question, I am here on behalf of the Friends of Memorial Coliseum Preservation Group. We are here simply to urge you to select a building plan that protects and preserves this landmark, a plan that is mindful of cost, honors the sacrifice of our veterans, and is truly sustainable. In our mind, there is only one way to do that, by preserving Memorial Coliseum as an arena, and this is an important part, with its original seating bowl intact. The Friends Memorial Coliseum is joined by organizations like the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the United States Green Building Council, and the American Institute of Architects, which all call for the entire building, including its original seating bowl, to be preserved. This is also specified in the National Register listing. Memorial Coliseum is not only the world's only transparent arena, but is, in spirit, a democratic community place like other Portland treasures such as Pioneer Courthouse Square or Waterfront Park. In this arena, the cheapest seats in the house have the best view of the city through the glass box. The Coliseum is also active. It actually hosted more events in 2009 than the Rose Garden. The entire building, we believe, is also a tribute to veterans, not just the walls on the names outside. Both my grandfathers are World War II veterans. One of them landed at the beaches of Normandy during the invasion, and the other was on an aircraft carrier sunk in the Battle of the Coral Sea in World War II in the Pacific. And I earnestly believe that the entire glass palace is a tribute to them and not just the small memorial outside, as a beacon of the future. We also would like to say that we applaud the good intentions of finalists like the VMAAC for championing arts, the MARC for promoting amateur athletics, or the alternate finalist Community Crossroads for advocating cultural diversity. But quite simply, you can build these visions anywhere. Why destroy a city landmark to do it? And wouldn't these visions work better if distributed amongst Portland's neighborhoods instead of in the middle of the city? We believe also that with due respect to everyone, that in a certain sense, each Coliseum finalist is making a kind of power grab, no matter how noble their cause may be, no matter how many earnest supporters they bring to council chambers, or how many John Lennon songs they play in their PowerPoint presentation. These people, although maybe good people, want the building for their purposes, and in some cases, their profit. I'm here on behalf of the silent majority with no money and no land to gain. We just want to protect a local treasure. Preserving Memorial Coliseum as an arena is also, without any question, the greenest, most sustainable choice. Demolishing the interior, as the MARC or the VMAAC propose, would erase all the building's embodied energy and release its stored carbon, especially when you take out one original seating bowl and replace it with another. And I know I'm out of time. I'm saying the final aspect is cost. Keeping the Coliseum as an arena is vastly, vastly cheaper than any other option, which we think is important for cash-strapped Portland. Luckily, it's also the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Harley.
Go ahead.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Aaron Laddin. I'm here to speak on behalf of myself, but I'll incorporate some interest from some people who couldn't be here today. Help bring track back to Portland. Over 20 years ago, the Memorial Coliseum hosted the Oregon Indoor Meet and attracted athletes from all over the country and packed the house. Since that time, the Oregon Indoor Meet has expired, but the spirit of track and field remains in Portland. When the city requested proposals for redevelopment of the Coliseum, it was obvious that indoor track couldn't be the only use of the building. So we didn't really submit a proposal that would make the Coliseum such that. Now that there's been an incorporation of mixed-use athletic and recreation centers, the track and field community has really come together and seen the possibility of bringing track and field back. The Rose Quarter Stakeholder Advisory Committee has initially determined that recreation spaces may be a feasible element of the Coliseum, and I believe the Coliseum represents a unique opportunity to bring track and field back. feasibility is really based off of the fact that there are no indoor competitive facilities in Oregon. The history of track races at this Coliseum, as well as interest from runners. Included in information I provided is a letter from USA Track and Field Oregon, which indicates that they're interested in bringing events back, as well as having this center be a real launching point for track and field in the city. The ability of track and field also blends with all the other uses. As we have stated, it's not the only use of the building. I just want to bring forward the community interests that are kind of lacking at this point to show that a particular rec center is really interested in some of these proposals. My fear, though, in this process is that existing agreements underlying the process will not allow for the coordination and integration of stakeholders. Athletic elements are likely to only add to commercial and residential plans for the Rose Quarter, while not limiting the current spectator and entertainment revenue currently in place. We need to partner small interests, whether they're curlers, bikers, swimmers, or runners, with financial feasibility, community popularity, and potential for Portland. In particular, Portland is a place for running, so let's try to bring that forward. However, at this time, only the MARC proposal is considered a world-class indoor track facility into the building, and it's an idea worth pursuing. The goal of the City Council should be to work to make sure that energy and vitality are brought to the Rose Quarter. Start today by bringing together the energetic, enthusiastic interests of our small groups of recreational people, whether they're runners or anything else. Help bring track back to Portland. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you for your testimony, and thanks for waiting. Sir.
Well, of course, I'm Harley Waddell. I am representing the veterans' interests. The big thing that we're really pleased with is the fact that the building has been saved by the Historical Society, that everything that is there is supposedly to stay. I understand that the bowl and the plaza are all part of this this granting of historical basis. We'd like to think that the veterans have a stake in this building that we have never been able to utilize. The veterans were promised a great deal and have not seen any of it come true. We'd like to address the fact that there are an awful lot of things that the veterans need at the present time. They need space for different service organizations. They need space for, or would like to have space, I should say, for helping take care of some of the homeless veterans. We have people coming back from overseas that have no jobs. We'd like to think that we could help them find jobs. All of this could be taken care of if space was set aside in the Memorial Coliseum for the veterans to use, put to use, and address this as a phase one aspect of this whole proposition. The idea being, by making this phase one, the veterans can go ahead, get things started. Then after the veterans are established and taking care of things, all of the rest of this can be done afterwards and the other problems addressed. In other words, whose proposal is going to be taken into play? At the moment, there is no plan out there. We've not been able to develop a plan for the veterans' areas. We'd like to do that. We have, but we're not getting any help from the different proposers. Unfortunately, they say that they're going to do an awful lot for the veterans. But to this point in time, the veterans have not seen a plan. We'd like to think that if this could be a phase one proposition, that we could develop a plan, put that into effect, get busy on it, and get this set so that when Veterans Day comes around in November, that the change of name for the building to the Veterans Memorial Coliseum could be dedicated at that time. We would have things established well enough so that everybody in the community could see what it is that is going to be accomplished.
And I appreciate Mr. Riddell. You've been a faithful advocate and a very effective one, attending all the meetings, and I appreciate the extra time that you've taken to meet with me and my staff. And we are looking at the November or earlier to fulfill the commitments made to the veterans back when the Coliseum was first opened but has since withered away, and including the name change. So I appreciate your advocacy. We're on track to do that. We're also going to provide some shape, if this moves forward, to how the proposers can interact with the veterans and seek the input of the veterans in a sort of systematic way. So points well made.
If it's at all possible, we would like to meet with you in your office sometime in the near future.
You can count on it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. The next three
are Stuart Emmons, Randy Rappaport, and Steve Liske.
Mr. Emmons, Mr. Rappaport, Mr. Liske.
Great.
Thanks. Okay.
Welcome back. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Mr. Emmons, do you want to start?
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. I handed out some books that are about the base case. I'm representing Friends Memorial Coliseum and also the base case. Friends are a volunteer organization that helps save Memorial Coliseum and advocates for its preservation and restoration. Memorial Coliseum can act as a centerpiece for a Rose Quarter that is more active and community-oriented. The Friends are concerned that one of the selected proposals completely demolishes the historic interior and attempts to replace the beautiful historic seating bowl with a replica bowl, one for $15 to $30 million of additional cost that I think public funds will be used for. One other damages the historic interior beyond repair. Some proposals would hand developers millions of dollars of community funds, and some proposals give full control of a community building to private parties who may have other interests beyond community. And alarmingly, the Friends are concerned that most proposals will soon ask for exorbitant public funds. I was the co-author of the base case book. The base case is not the status quo. The base case is very tied to the majority report aspirational statement. We sought to find the baseline for the minimum amount of public investment that it would take to reawaken the Coliseum, honor its historic integrity, maximize the community benefit, and maximize the return on our investment. It was a strategy virtually identical to the veterans and several other community proposals, but with the added value of making Memorial Coliseum more profitable. Of the final proposals, it is probably closer to the Blazer Winterhawk scheme, but it is more economical and more community-oriented by requiring fewer public funds. It addresses deferred maintenance, restores the Coliseum, and adds a little sparkle that will make this an icon in our city with special lighting. Imagine a creatively lit huge glass box that our whole city can see. It will be a fantastic tribute to our veterans. I would predict that it is significantly less cost than the Blazer Winterhawk scheme and a small fraction of the other schemes. And it is the only idea that will sail through historic review. The base case can be phased also over five or more years to reduce upfront costs for our city. The base case is not designed to not require a bond measure. Let upcoming bond measures and urban renewal funds focus on more critical community priorities, such as schools and housing. Jobs are needed now, and you'll see a job chart in there. Base case can start this project very soon. The three proposals are years and years away. Memorial Coliseum was built as a community building. We want it to remain a community building. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Emmons. Mr. Rappaport.
Thank you. My name is Randy Rappaport. I live on the east side. Okay. I'm thankful that the council has taken time to ensure a good outcome for the fate of the Memorial Coliseum. I'm here to testify for saving the architectural treasure of our city. I do think it's worth saving. I understand that some of the proposals would require destruction of the bowl inside the Memorial Coliseum. I'm really against that. As you know, last year, City Council received letters from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, also the United States Green Building Council, and the American Institute of Architects, all calling for the entire building to be preserved, which is part of the Coliseum's National Register listing. Is it actually on the...
Yes.
It is. So it's actually on the National Register. I read that letter, and they really do call out specifically in that letter for saving the bowl as it is. I wanted to emphasize that. So we should question the appropriateness of proposals which would be counter to the findings of the National Trust and all of the other professionals. I want to add my name to the list of citizens that believe that the Memorial Coliseum should be kept whole and rehabilitated as you deem appropriate, resulting in an economically viable entertainment facility for the future. And then I want to speak just for a moment about the architectural significance and its the historic thread that the bowl really has. And I have a picture to show. Can I put a picture up? Is it possible?
It would take 30 minutes.
No,
probably.
I want to show you guys.
You can.
I want to show you all.
We'll
the pictures.
Take your computer.
I have a picture to show you at the end, but okay. So I'm going to do this historical thread. The bowl is an example of fourth dimension architecture that began with Le Corbusier when he was exploring this in the 1920s, which is like the beginning of modernism. The Memorial Coliseum, built in 1960, was at the very end of this period, of this modernist period. The bowl in particular explores holistic, organic form. The bowl has initial elements of biomorphism, architectural philosophy, that is just now being completed on the physical plane, such as Zaha Hadid's Museum of Art for the 21st Century in Rome, just completed. But even more, in the final point, more specifically, Zaha Hadid they're just finishing the Olympic stadium for the aquatic stadium in London. And I want to show you a picture of that. So this is the latest in architecture from a, she was a, what did she win that? She's the great, she won that great award, so, the Pritzker.
Mr. Rappaport, I need you to wrap up.
All right.
And you can hand your computer to the council clerk.
This is a very cool picture.
Why? This is the bowl. This is Zaha's, the greatest architect, I think. They're just building this.
So thank you.
This thing.
Where at?
In London.
London.
For the 2012 Olympics.
Thank you very much.
It kind of ties into our bowl.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Hello. Welcome.
Oh, good evening, I guess. My name is Steve Liske. I'm the president of the Evergreen Curling Club, and I am here on behalf of the organization to speak in favor of the MARC. Very briefly, just a little background about our organization. We are a local nonprofit organization. We curl at Lloyd Center. I hope you got to watch some curling during the Olympics. It's a great sport. At our club, we host weekly leagues, community events. We had a wheelchair curling event that was very popular. So those are the sorts of things that we do. Like many team sports, curling has a lot to offer to those who participate, particularly for our youth. It teaches valuable life lessons. It's also good exercise. If you've ever watched it, sweeping is actually quite difficult, so it is good exercise. Unlike other team sports, virtually anybody can curl. Any shape, size, age, ability can curl. We have teenagers, we have 70-somethings curl, We have some wheelchair curlers in our leagues, so it's a great sport, offers a lot of benefits. Really, curling does offer unique, not only typical benefits, but unique benefits, and I think the MARC proponents realize this, and that's why they have included curling as a part of their facility, and is one of the reasons why we're supporting supporting the MARC. In addition, simply the MARC proponents and Evergreen Curling Club value family-oriented athletic activities as a means to promote community well-being. Last but not least, Evergreen Curling Club believes that the facility being proposed by the MARC is needed here in Portland. And I'll give you one example that we've experienced recently that led us to that conclusion. During the Olympics and in the weeks following, we had nearly 700 people come out to learn to curl. We expected 200 or 300, and we were just completely overwhelmed. That number would have been much higher, but we were limited by the amount of ice time we could rent. And to us, it's just a perfect example of how Portlanders enjoy and seek out activities that are unique, fun, interesting, that keep them active, and enhance their health and well-being. The MARC is a facility that meets these demands, is exactly what Portlanders want, need, and deserve, and we ask that the MARC be given an equal and fair opportunity to be selected as a preferred alternative.
So, question, wouldn't any ice do? I mean, if you're currently at the Lloyd Center?
Well, we're limited to the ice that we can rent, because skaters get it most of the time, and the quality of the ice is very poor.
But the Winterhawks ice, would, if they'd let you on it, would work?
Well, it would be on the community ice rink in the MARC, not on the Winterhawks ice.
Right, but if that's not the chosen scheme, there's nothing particular, because they can put the lanes on any ice.
Well, not really, because it's like you can't put a Zamboni machine on curling ice. It would be like trying to mow a putting green with a riding John Deere mower. It leaves ruts, and it's very unlevel. So the quality is just not there.
It's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Next three are Paula Noel McPhee, Trudy Ruser, and Gary Marschke.
Hi, welcome. Glad you're here. Thanks for waiting.
They'll be followed by Kathy Galbraith, Lisa Reed Gennaro, and Brian Parrott, I believe is the last name.
Do you want to begin?
Thanks. This is my first time, so thank you for this opportunity. It's very exciting. I'm a member of this community. I've been born and raised in Oregon. My name is Dr. Paula Noel McPhee. I have been an educator in resolving cultural and community conflict, and I now study it as I am a single mother and I also live with multiple sclerosis. As an athlete in the past, I am currently striving for an active community lifestyle that is accessible to somebody like me living within the parameters of a very low income. I grew up attending events at the Rose Quarter and the Memorial Coliseum. I would like the development of this area to benefit somebody like me. Basically, at this point in time, I don't use it because I can't afford it. I have been following this process, and I have concern with the integrity of this process. This is my first time hearing the details of all of these proposals. I cannot help but ask two obvious questions. Number one, what is the point of this process if the terms of the operating agreement is to be negotiated after all the time and money is spent submitting proposals? And number two, if PAM can veto any proposal, what is the point of this process? I support what Mayor Adams said earlier today, finding a credible process to redetermine the operating agreement before proposals are being submitted so the process is fair to the proposal that is chosen. So even more time and money isn't spent after a proposal is selected, and that would possibly be changed because of the operating agreement or a veto. I ask for all of us to find the right balance. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to speak, and hope you're doing well.
Glad to see you.
Thank you. As in the past, I represent the interests of veterans. I don't have any formal group, but my husband was in the Marine Corps for 28 years and did a lot in that time. So I just love veterans. Also, I have to say I love the Blazers. I think everyone loves the Blazers. But I don't love the Blazers to do everything for me. They're not, nobody can do everything and everything well and appropriately. So I think that it's important for the public to know who makes the decisions for Portland. Is it the Blazers? I hope not. It's painful to make a change when you're committed to a process or a goal that you can see. It's right down there and you can see it. Difficult to reassess and step back and make a change even if you recognize it's necessary. I used to teach how to live in rapid change at Hewlett-Packard, and I know that it's always difficult, even when you think the change is positive. To do what is needed in the most efficient process and to produce the most beneficial final results for the community is what we're looking for. So one of the ideas that keeps coming up is that it has to be a more intimate area. Making an area unique and intimate, whatever size, is easy and cheap to do within the bowl that's there. Go to Japan just one time, and you can see they're masters at it. And it's cheap. It's curtains on wheels. And you can create the most wonderful environments for every event that you have. And everyone can be unique. Also, the cost of asbestos is a lot more expensive than curtains. If I own a restaurant, I would not hire my competition to manage it and hope that my restaurant would be profitable. The majority report, by the way, was very similar to the minority report, except that the bottom line. And I analyzed these points as they came across and find that the minority approach would actually meet those requirements better. Better than the majority report, than the majority view. Also, the reporters of the majority did not read the minority report. They were way off. They had no idea what's in there because it's completely different from what they thought it was. So meeting the veterans' needs is first, serving the public interest for the least amount of money and as early as possible. That's my goal. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Really appreciate it. Sir?
Yes, Gary Marshke, representing my own self. First of all, I did want to address the idea about the audit. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to determine that one could routinely show a loss by pricing individual events accordingly and then hide them in the aggregate numbers. Not saying the Blazers are doing that, but certainly I would support an audit, I think, at least for that reason. It also disturbs me that we're expected to be impressed by all of these out-of-town entities that are part of these other proposals. What happened to buying local first? I'm also testifying, though, in support of the Rose Quarter Community Crossroads recommendation, and in particular, the inclusion of housing, with an emphasis on affordable, on-site. Without a significant housing component on-site, I believe that any development, with all due respect to the great minds behind the current proposals, is destined to manifest the very definition of insanity, repeating the same things and expecting different outcomes, a.k.a. as a destination only. If the past 17 years of experience has demonstrated anything clearly, it's that the building as a destination only does not mean that they will come. Activating the Coliseum and the Rose Quarter grounds 24/7 requires open, free access and housing on site. Simply staging events, hosting activities, and developing specialized services without a resident population on site is destined to fail. Rose Quarter Community Crossroads, with its open access housing on site and varied revenue streams, provides a realistic, sustainable alternative to simply more of the same insanity. Thank you.
What was that word you said a lot?
That was on site, Mr. Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
The next three are Kathy Goldbreth, Lisa Reed Gennaro, and Brian Parrott.
Welcome back to City Council. Thanks for waiting.
Well, now I have to say good evening instead of good afternoon.
Yes.
I'm Kathy Galbraith. I'm the executive director of the Bosco Milligan Foundation. We operate the Architectural Heritage Center with the local partner organization of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. There's been a lot of media and
Kathy,
attention.
Could you bring
and
the mic down a little bit?
A lot of media attention and side conversations being paid to who's got access to capital, the need for a level playing field, the benefit of existing agreements, and sort of other concerns. But we, the Bosco Milligan Foundation and the National Trust, maintain the preservation of the Memorial Coliseum, and its primary defining features are really integral to its future use, and that includes preservation of the bowl. We respect all of the proponents. There's lots of firepower on all of the teams. All of the proponents have the equal opportunity to preserve the bowl. The Blazers proposal currently is the most aggressive of all of the options that protects the bowl as a primary historic feature. Some of the other proposals that would suggest that we demolish and replace the bowl does not. This, I think, today is really about setting the ground rules for the next step in the of the RFP process. It's not just the box that matters, but some of the very significant internal features of the building, and that includes the bowl. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi. I'm Lisa Reed Guarnero. Today I'm representing Vision Into Action as well as the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We believe today a delegation of 10 key leaders from the public, private, and non-profit sector convened to explore lessons learned from their San Diego trip to view the Market Creek development, a model of community-responsive, community-driven development. The Market Creek Plaza is a 10-acre, 23.5 million commercial real estate development project in a historically underinvested neighborhood of San Diego. It is among the nation's first real estate development projects to be designed, built, and ultimately owned in the most literal sense by community residents. Portland leaders looked at their use of an initial public offering that allowed more than 400 local investors to invest $500,000 in the development, allowing community members to become stakeholders and stakeholders in the site, creating a unique asset building opportunity for the neighborhoods. This resident-led effort has already resulted in important breakthroughs. Minority contracting. 69% of the construction contracts for the Market Creek Plaza were awarded to local minority-owned enterprises, totaling $7.1 million. Local hiring. 91% of the initial employment of Food for Less were hired from communities. All these jobs are unionized and include living wages, health care, and pension plans. Civic participation. 2,000 adults and over 1,000 youth have participated in land planning, leasing, marketing, research, advocacy, and ownership design. Extensive cultural cross-cultural teams have played an ongoing role in project implementation. Neighborhood reinvestment. Residents have designed a locally controlled foundation, which has been chartered and approved as a 501c3 neighborhood corporation, to grant a portion of the profits from the development back into the neighborhood. Vision Into Action and Center for Intercultural Organizing and our partners encourage council to take advantage of this opportunity to listen and learn from our delegation's findings and recommendations on how this might be applied to Portland's current and future developments, including the Memorial Coliseum and the Rose Quarter area. Also, a quick reminder that the Memorial Coliseum was dedicated in addition to honoring our veterans. It was also dedicated to the advancement of cultural opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and again, thanks for waiting. Hi, welcome back.
Brian Parrott, and I'm here as a private citizen and not representing any individual in particular. I have rented the Coliseum. I counted up 59 times, three Davis Cups, and the Tournament of the Americas being the four biggest events. And I, a year ago, had written a letter saying, please save the Coliseum because it's an asset. I love what Merritt Paulson is doing with soccer, but baseball is part of the community, but that would not have been the right place. So I'm here to say thank you to the mayor and the council for what you've done in allowing the city to go forward. Also, I think it should be said and maybe more widely known, we are now the only city in the United States to have two buildings side by side. Philadelphia stopped operating the Spectrum, and so we're in a very unique, which is what I said 2 years ago, situation. We've got a competitive advantage that I think all of the proposals, you know, have capacity. Now, I want to encourage you to look at the accounting, the audit and stuff, because for two reasons. One is the Davis Cup alone. I know it was publicized, you know, $7 million are brought into the city, but it was a very good rental, and the catering alone would have been a significant figure. Now, that kind of stuff should be in there, hopefully, you know, when you analyze an event. Catering, parking, but even merchandising, but the USTA took all of the merchandising in that particular thing. But the hidden benefit that that building has, and when the figures came out that it was losing money and all that, but the thing is that hotel revenue, restaurant revenue, cab revenue, that's not figured in there, and that's there. I mean, that's what that little building and both buildings now do for us. So I don't know how it's accounted for, but it goes beyond just the hard numbers. And it goes further in events when we got lucky, when NEC discovered Oregon with the first Davis Cup, it was hundreds of millions of dollars worth of silicone development over there or out in Hillsboro. I want to conclude by saying I have an idea. All these ideas cost money. And I have an idea how to raise the funds and also create tourism good for convention business. And I've spoken to the parties involved, and I would be in position and be willing to raise the private capital necessary to pull this off. But I think there could be a cool partnership within the cultural community, including the tribe. So I'll stop there. My time is done. But again, it's thank you to you guys for what you've done and what you're doing and all the people.
Tell your idea to Kevin or Amy, right back
Coliseum
there.
Coliseum Casino.
Anyway, moving on.
The last person who signed up is Tom Kilbane.
Tom? Mr. Kilbane? I don't see him. All right. Additional discussion from council for staff?
I have a couple of just questions. I mean, we've gone this long. If we're going to be voting
sure.
on it. I'd...
Why don't you all come up?
Oh, we've gone through.
Go ahead.
Welcome. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening.
I figure good night.
What's missing is,
I'm good tomorrow.
What's missing is, you know,
good night.
Coffee and muffins are being served over here for breakfast. So I have a few questions, if I could. Based on the action that you're asking us to take tonight, would the council have any formal role in the shaping of a request for proposals?
At this point, we have substantial completion on the RFP. If the council would wish to review the content of the document prior to release, we could do that.
If you issue an RFP, well, let me back up a sec. We've had this at the Portland Housing Bureau, where before we issue an RFP, we sometimes bring in our key contracting parties, and we try to make sure we anticipate what some of the issues are to ensure a level playing field with an RFP, and then we issue it. So if you issue an RFP and shortly thereafter one or more of the applicants says, time out, the RFP doesn't work for some fundamental reason, how would we learn of that?
We do have currently a 24-hour, which is pretty quick, turnaround period for all of the top three teams to consider whether they're willing to move forward with the RFP.
Yeah.
So during that time frame, they will have the opportunity to review content and decide whether they're going to move forward with the process.
But if I could, we also do the same thing in our technology request for proposals, and I think that getting a draft RFP out for not only the council to look at, but for anyone in the public makes sense as well in this.
We also had a stakeholder advisory committee subcommittee that met specifically to look at the RFP and give feedback, including Professor Macht and Rosemary, who both testified today.
But how does the 24-hour window jive with the mayor's suggestion that we air it out a little bit?
I think we definitely have the opportunity to consider expansion of that time frame. It was a quick turnaround with the understanding that the teams that are potentially moving forward have a clear picture of what would be required in a typical RFP that PDC would issue, with the most recent example being Centennial Mills. So the content of Centennial Mills, for example, would very much be in line with the content of the RFP that we're considering for.
But one advantage of extending the 24-hour clock, I think, for any of us is that if there was a serious concern, we'd have a chance to hear it and at least process it. 24 hours sounds like the Randy Leonard school of getting things done. I mean, it might be a little aggressive, but we might want to extend it.
He insults you. You have an 8-hour turnaround. What are you talking about? So we will. I'm happy to commit to a reasonable period of time for the council and for the public to give us feedback. Obviously, we're not going to, and I don't think you're suggesting this, settle the sort of are we going to be successful at getting a negotiated sort of new agreement or not, but I think you're not suggesting that.
No, I'm just talking about a significant red flag. I don't intend to get involved in drafting an RFP.
We'll come back and suggest a timeline.
Yep. The next question I have is, what happens if in the responses to the RFP, you determine that there are components of each which, if blended into something else, creates a best in class, but that no individual proposal. How might that play out? That components that you like in different responses could potentially be either blended or a proposal enhanced based on some creative idea that comes out of the response to an RFP?
So typically what happens is a proposal is selected from the pool of proposers, and typically quite a bit of negotiation happens after that selection. So there is the opportunity for the city to potentially leverage additional public funding to create more public amenity within the facility, for example. So there is usually a significant amount of change that can occur from the selection of the proposer to the final negotiation of a development agreement.
And just so I'm clear, if a creative idea comes out of a losing proposal, the city would have the option of saying to the winning proposal, we'd like you to figure out how this might fit into your concept and come back to us.
That's correct.
And in the next phase, as you'll see in the RFP, marriages and the blending is absolutely allowed.
Yep.
Another question, if I may, and I just have a few here and then I'll shut up. The base case. And we've heard that from some that the base case could be strengthened if we had more information or different circumstances. But in light of the amendment that we adopted at the beginning of this hearing, what if it turns out the base case is the best of the field? How is the base case officially part of the contest?
So, and Mayor Adams, please weigh in, but the way that we've outlined it, the intent of our earlier engagement of Bora Architects and other consultants in creating a baseline condition analysis for the facility was for us as the city to do our due diligence in order to determine what it would cost to just bring the facility up to current. So essentially bringing the base case to fruition. So I believe that the city council has within its purview the ability to select that as the chosen option if that seems to be the option that's most supported.
And I think I would add that's a facility sort of related part of the answer. The other part of the answer is then having that in hand, what kind of agreement would we want to negotiate and with who around the base case?
Correct. Again, and my final question is, since we're...
Currently we do not have the resources solely on the public side to bring the facility up to, in a base case scenario, but to bring the facility up to current code.
That's correct.
I just want to make sure people know that.
That's correct.
I guess the final question I would have is that the cost is going to be a significant factor that we're going to have to consider, and how we fund any proposal is a significant issue we're going to have to grapple with. it's somewhat unusual to launch a process where that is back-ended because, frankly, one of our challenges is to figure out how a potential cost is weighed against some other competing use and priority. So it's challenging. As someone said, this is an unconventional process, and I take that for both its the positive and challenging features. But will the RFP address cost in any way, or is this cost neutral at least from the until you get a proposal in the door?
So, and if you want to weigh in, but the RFP will request specific sources and uses analysis of sources of capital and uses of capital, and essentially that will it will require the teams to make a specific public ask for their project.
But that's proposal. Different. I mean that says.
Let me in. So having been involved with the negotiations for the Pearl District development agreement and South Waterfront development agreement, this is more analogous to that. We're dealing with just one piece of it, but in the end, whoever is selected for both Memorial Coliseum and with the build-out of the remainder of the quarter, it will be a development agreement that will include whatever multiple parties are involved with that. So in that sense, this is more analogous to a neighborhood development agreement as opposed to just a single facility, which is more common before the city council. And so the whole thing is very iterative.
So I kind of understand that, but I haven't been through those processes. So if I can just state it so that, in a plain way that I can understand it. Once an applicant has identified possible sources, $100 million bond measure, $50 million in TIF, whatever someone says, and then locks it up. And they fulfilled that piece of their responsibility in their response. Do you evaluate whether that's feasible? Do you look at that as whether that is politically possible or feasible in making your determination about a winner?
Correct.
Yes. And the viability and how are we protected on any private contribution as well. Anybody, any claim that any of the proposers make in terms of bringing non-city government or non-PDC revenues to the table, we assess the veracity of that. And the staff will give you their opinion on whether they think the claim is valid or not.
Okay, thank you.
Additional discussion? Thank you very much. Carla, would you please call the vote?
Fish.
Well, this has been a fascinating hearing, and I very much appreciate the testimony and the presentation, and most of the people involved in this have now gone on to some other event, so they can...
It's often the case.
Read
in our
about
work.
It in the paper. I've been working on another speech about housing and trying to figure out how we work through the mess that is caused by a national recession and how we deal with factors beyond our control. And I've been looking for inspiration for this speech, and I finally found it in something that Abraham Lincoln said in 1862, in a totally different context. But he said, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, but we must rise with the occasion." And in the context of housing and the impact of the recession and collapse in our healthcare system, mental health and everything else, I think it is quite apt. Lincoln, of course, was talking about, was said that at the in the middle of a war and just before he signed that proclamation that changed history. So there was a slightly different set of scale of stakes. But I think this occasion, though, is piled high with difficulty. And that's why we've had a long hearing, and we're going to have a robust debate. And so I just want to take a couple minutes to share with people who are here who've been courteous and stayed late, and they should get the benefit of our thought process. And I'm going to take a couple minutes just to explain how I get to my outcome. And I apologize if it cuts into your dinner hour, but I think it's important. So for me, this is an unconventional process, and there's a lot of the details which I would prefer to have resolved at the front end of the process, quite honestly. I'm just more familiar with that in how we do things. And that's not a criticism of anyone who's been involved in this process, but it is as was advertised, unconventional. And there are certain aspects of this that I would like to have a clearer understanding of at the front end. And one is, why are we doing this? What are the opportunity costs?